Buchanan. He says, flying home from London, where the subject of formal debate on the 70th anniversary of World War II had been whether or not Winston Churchill was a liability or an asset to the free world, one arrives in the middle of a far more acrimonious national debate right here in the United States. At issue, should Barack Obama be allowed to address 10,000 or tens of millions of American children inside their classroom during school hours? He mentions here the White House turned a Northwest Washington Junior High classroom into a television studio, because that was years ago. Obama's speech was not controversial. It was similar to Nancy Reagan's appeal to just say no to drugs. Yet the episode reveals the poisoned character of our politics. We saw it earlier on display in August when crowds came out for a town hall meetings to oppose Obama's health care plans, and those people were called thugs, fascists, racists, and evil mongers by National Democrats. This last week, we had a representative shout, "You lie," at the president during his address of a joint session of Congress. We seem not only to disagree with each other more than ever, but to have almost come to detest one another. Politically, culturally, racially, we seem ever ready to go for each other's throats. One half of America sees abortion as the animal slaughter or annual slaughter of a million unborn children. The other half regards the right to life movement as tyrannical and sexist. Proponents of gay marriage see its adversaries as homophobic bigots. Opponents see its champions as seeking to elevate unnatural and immoral relationships to the sacred state of marriage. The question invites itself, in what sense are we one nation and one people anymore? For what is a nation if not a people of common ancestry, common faith, culture, and language, who worship the same God, revere the same heroes, cherish the same history, celebrate the same holidays, and share the same music, poetry, art, and literature? Yet today, Mexican Americans celebrate Cinco de Mayo, a minor skirmish in the French-Mexican War about which Americans know nothing. It took place at approximately the same time as two of the bloodiest battles in our own Civil War, Antietam and Fredericksburg. We were used to having classical, pop, country, western, and jazz music. Now we have varieties tailored to specific generations, races, and ethnic groups. Even our music seems designed to subdivide us. One part of America loves her history, another reviles it as racist, imperialist, and genocidal. Old heroes like Columbus, Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee are replaced by Dr. King and Cesar Chavez. We are not only more divided than ever on politics, faith, and morality, but on the lines of class and ethnicity. The European Christian core of our country that once defined us is shrinking, and as Christianity fades, the birth rate falls and immigration surges. E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one, was the national motto of the men of 76. One sees the pluribus, but where is the unum? One sees the diversity, but where is the unity? Then he asks the question, is America breaking up too? Very insightful observation, the result of what has happened in our nation and what has happened all across the world, what is happening because of man's inability to govern himself is with us. We see it illustrated more and more every year. In just a few weeks, in fact, just 3 weeks from today, we'll be keeping the very first day of the Feast of Tabernacles. And we need to understand that the Feast of Tabernacles is primarily about government, about bringing Jesus Christ here to rule the earth with a proper and right government and to answer the first of the two big questions of life. The first question, obviously, is who's going to rule the earth? Who is going to rule the kingdom? That answer we know. Jesus Christ is going to come back and rule the earth and rule the kingdom for at least 1,000 years. The second great question in life is who is going to rule you? That question you have the choice to answer. You have to decide if you're going to rule yourself or if you're going to let Jesus Christ rule your life. That's a choice none of us can make for you. You have to make it yourself. But as a overall study of why we are going to the feast, as an overall idea of why God commands us to keep these feasts every year, but especially the Feast of Tabernacles, I thought I would do a macro look at the concept of human government. How did nation becomes established? How did they form the governments that they have today? And did God give them perhaps a better example that they have ignored? I want to begin today over in Genesis chapter 4, beginning in verse 16. This is essentially the beginning of human governments upon the earth. If we do a study as to how people are organized, how they pass laws, how they administer those laws, how they put themselves into organizations, this will be the very first place to start. And it starts with a man named Cain, who murdered his brother Abel. Now keep in mind that by this time, they were probably up in their 20s. They certainly were not children anymore. They had their own vocations. Cain was a worker of the field. Abel had sheep, and he had goats. He had flocks to tend. Tradition says that Adam and Eve had 26 children. So by this time, I'm going to venture a guess that some had married, some had found, you know, mates in life and had other children, and there probably may have been 100 people alive, somewhere around 100 people on the earth. So I wanted to tell you, this Wednesday, my daughter-in-law goes in for a first sonogram, and I'll find out if I'm going to be a grandma or a grandpa. Or something like that, something like that. All I can say is if it's a girl, my wife has to buy entirely new clothes for that kid because she has a big, huge grocery bag, no, a big, big plastic garbage bag full of little cowboy outfits and little Carhartts and all that kind of thing. So we'll see. But I keep telling her I'm the prophet and the family she's not. But she argues with that too. Let's get back to where we were. There were 100 people on the earth approximately. That's just, you know, an educated guess. I'm not saying absolutely for sure, but there were a number of people there. So when Cain killed his brother here in chapter 4, God said to him, you have to be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. That's verse 12. Now, before the flood, there was no death penalty. That's why after the flood, God told Noah, the very first thing he told Noah after the ark landed, he said, if a man sheds blood, then by man he must have his blood shed. Now, that doesn't mean he cut his finger. Recall that Jesus Christ shed his blood for us, he died. So one of the very first things God told Noah was you better have a system of enforcing laws, and there is a capital crime for murder, and they should be carried out. Because there was not a capital crime for murder, and because there was not a system of carrying out laws, very, very quickly mankind descended to the place where God regretted even having created him. So Cain said in verse 13, Cain didn't say, I'm sorry, I repent, I'm evil, I've done wrong. No, he said, my punishment is greater than I can bear. A very typical spoiled child approach to being punished. Then he said, surely you have driven me out of this place. And he said, I'll be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth, and anyone that finds me will kill me. Notice, Cain's concern is self-protection. He doesn't want anybody else to take vengeance upon him. So what does he do to protect himself? Verse 16, Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. Now, historically, most Bible scholars agree this is the area of Jericho. It's east to the land of Jerusalem. It's down in that, you know, the valley of the Jordan River, a very, very gorgeous area as far as a lot of fruit and trees and production. There's desert essentially on four sides of it, but it's a very productive area. So he went to the land of Nod, also called Jordan. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch, and he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. Now, if you've been to Jericho, anybody here been to Jericho? Probably most of you have, several of you have been. One of the tourist trappy things you go see is a round pile of rocks, and it's excavated way down. It's probably 50 to 60 feet below the current surface level, but it's a round tower built out of river rocks. They're not cut and shaped rocks. They're basically round rocks like a small football size. And this tower was made out of, this is all that's left, of course, is the foundation, maybe 30 or 40 feet of it. But it is called the Tower of Cain. And the tour guides will tell you this is the tower built by Cain when he was kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And he came over here with his wife and bore Enoch. And, of course, the name of Jericho, you know, technically should be Enoch, apparently. Although there it was covered up with water during the flood, but the tower remained when the water subsided. So we know that he, Cain, built a city. And he built that city to protect himself from other people harming him. And, of course, he set up then a system where he was kind of the king, the dictator, and everybody in his family, in his control, had to answer to him. We have then the establishing of a system of government where families became cities, cities became larger city-states, and eventually became much larger city-states, and they were all governed by a tyrant, by a king who owned everything, by a man who had the law of life and death, who could confiscate property. The average person was living in misery, in poverty. Finding enough to eat every day was a challenge, and that system of government, sadly, is still with us today in many parts of the earth. But the government by tyrant was started by Cain, and we find that it continued and was actually institutionalized by a man named Nimrod. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 10, just the first account after the flood. So after the flood, we call that only Noah was just in his generations. His sons and their wives were saved with him during the flood in that big boat. We have kind of his history here in chapter 10. But if we drop down to verse 6, the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Phut, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, Shabtekah, and the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. Verse 8 says, Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. Now, if you look in any Bible map that lists where all the families of Noah were settled to after the flood, you find that Cush and his descendants primarily settled the area that is today Ethiopia and Kenya. So that being the case, and if those descendants are still there, then it would be accurate to say that the current holder of the highest office in this land is a Cushite, and is in fact a cousin of Nimrod. I'm just talking about history here. I'm not talking about anything derogatory or accusatory. Just simply by looking at this lineage and knowing where Cush went, that would be the only conclusion we might make. Nimrod in verse 9, or verse 8, began to be a mighty one. The word actually is a tyrant, a tyrannos. He was a tyrant on the earth. Let me read to you something about Nimrod from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. Because he founded the system in Babylon that actually continues down to the time of the return of Jesus Christ, where Babylon, in its resurgent form, tries to fight and stop the return of Jesus Christ to control the earth. It says Nimrod here is a descendant of Ham, mentioned in the generations of Noah as the son of Cush. He established his kingdom in the land of Shinar, which includes the cities of Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh, of which only Babel or Babylon and Erech or Uruk have been identified with certainty. Now, Ur of the Chaldees area was where Abraham was called out of, so God called our father Abraham out of the system that Nimrod had started. Later, this entire area was called Chaldea. It was a more extensive territory than the Sumer inscriptions in the ancient royal title, King of Sumer and Akkad. It says, Nimrod, like other kings of Mesopotamian lands, was a mighty hunter, possibly the mightiest and the prototype of them all, since his name had attached itself to the proverb, you know, Nimrod, the mighty hunter, before or against or contrary to the Lord or Yahweh. In the primitive days in Mesopotamia, also in Palestine, wild animals were so numerous they became a menace to life and property. So after the flood, animals reproduced faster than people. There were only three families to start reproducing people. And, of course, their children had to get old enough to have children. And by that time, wild animals began to overpopulate the earth. So people looked to someone who could be a mighty hunter and protect them. So Nimrod did that. But the way he protected them was to put them in cities, organize them in close-quarter living areas where they would then go out during the day and work their fields. But in Nimrod's cities, out of that land, he went forth into Assyria and builded Nineveh. So after he established his area in Babylon, he set up a satellite or an extended kingdom in the area of Assyria, later became the area of Nimrod, which, of course, has been extensively excavated and studied by archaeologists. Nimrod has not been identified with any particular mythical hero or historic king of the inscriptions. Some identify him with others who are worshipped, like Marduk, chief god of Babylon, and some of the other Babylonian or Middle Eastern male gods that were being worshipped back then. He also was in control of Babylon and Ur of the Chaldees during the time when modern-day astrology and the figuring of the stars was originated. So Nimrod started to have this system of government, that was based on Keynes, where he organized people in cities and he controlled everything. Basically, these cities were built by Ham's children and they were all dictator types. Modern civilization back then was founded on the need for protection and founded by violence and whoever had the strongest military ability. Much different than what we have today. And in fact, if you look at how these things have come down through history, many nations have suffered under tyrants. These kings who were appointed either through military power or by themselves and began to think of themselves not as humans, but as part gods. In fact, the ancient kings of Egypt, called pharaohs, taught that they were gods themselves. They were the god Ra, or they were descended from the sun god. And of course, after they died, they got to go on this boat down the Nile River. They built massive tombs all full of gold and all sorts of gilded things so they could enjoy the afterlife. But the average person couldn't do that because the average person was basically scum, was basically, you know, a slave to serve the king. Alexander the Great went to the oracle at Delphi, and the oracle at Delphi told him that he was going to be the ruler of the world and that he was had this, you know, sort of God presence in him. But it was only when he went to Egypt after conquering Palestine and winning the Battle of Carchemish that he was actually went to one of these temples in Egypt where they told him that he was begotten by a god. It's even happened in our time. Some of us, I can't, but some can remember when Emperor Hirohito, after the defeat of Japan in 1945, went on the radio and told the people of Japan that he was not a half god, that he actually was a person just like them. Mr. Gunderson might remember those days. But the people of Japan murdered millions of other people because they swore allegiance to this emperor family that thought they were not actual people, but they were actually half gods. And so they were sort of somewhere between the deity and the average person. And when Emperor Hirohito went on the radio and said, "No, I'm a man just like the rest of you," the entire nation went into mourning. They almost couldn't deal with it, that they had gone to war to protect this god that they thought lived among them. And then he said, "No, I'm just a man." And it was a time of horrible national tragedy and self-immolation for the Japanese. And it was one way, one time when they were able then to have a different type of government instituted by Mr. MacArthur, who based the government of Japan, of course, on the United States Constitution. So we have this long history of the legacy of Cain and Nimrod, of men wanting to rule over and control and own and abuse and keep down other men, or men were property. Most people down through history have been serfs or have been slaves, and the everyday average experience has been one of misery and striving to get by. There have been a few civilizations in history where there were, you know, moments or times when there was some respect of the average person and some democracy, and we'll look at a couple of those. But the first one, of course, is in Exodus chapter 24. Keep in mind that when the people of Israel came out of Egypt, when God brought them out through that powerful miracle, all the plagues plus the Passover, that they came out from an experience of being slaves. In Egypt, Pharaoh was God. Then he had a layer of administrators and favored people who would be the upper class. But the 98-99% of everybody else were serfs. They were slaves. They didn't own land. They were simply lucky to survive from one day to the next. And that's the way all nations were. That was the accepted way of governing nations because Nimrod had set it up and that system spread from one place to the next. And those people who were the leaders or kings or thought they had divine right, they thought they were accountable to no one but perhaps some statue or some piece of wood or something in the heavens that they could look at. And of course, we all know those are essentially harmless. So in Exodus chapter 24, where God decides to start his own nation, this is absolutely revolutionary. This is a system of government never heard of before on the face of the earth. Notice what he says in chapter 24 and verse 1. He said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, representatives from all 12 tribes, and worship from afar." So don't come all the way up to the top of the mountain, stay at the bottom and worship. "Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with him." Now later, the one who became Jesus Christ comes down the mountain and has a dinner with them, but they don't go up to the top where he and all of his glory was. So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do. Now the first question is, what did Moses tell them? Where do we have those words of the Lord that Moses then told the people of Israel? Well, it's in the previous four chapters, Exodus 20, 21, 22, and 23. This is, from a technical standpoint, the Old Covenant. These are the words they agreed to. Now later, the Old Covenant sometimes is referred to as the Ten Commandments because it is the beginning of this entire four chapters, but it includes all four. And later, sometimes the Old Covenant includes all the things that were given later. And of course, some of the directives about the tabernacle and other laws, but the entire first five books of Moses sometimes expand to fulfill that title of the Old Covenant. But from a technical standpoint, the covenant they agreed to is in chapter 20, 21, 22, and 23 of Exodus. Now, what is really interesting in these four chapters, we sometimes read through them and, yeah, this is nice. Yeah, you know, somebody has a son, somebody sells a slave and gets it back, or men fight each other or whatever. But what is in this four chapters that's interesting is it tells them about how they are to govern themselves and how they're essentially, there is to be no king, but that every man, every head of house is to be responsible to God himself. They were not to oppress their strangers. They were not to afflict widows or fatherless. The helpless people in the society were protected by God. If an owner had an animal or a piece of property and it was harmed and he was owed restitution, that was to be done. All of this covenant involves each individual saying, I will obey God. And there is no king. There is no intermediary. It also talks about the feast days. And he mentioned that God is going to bring them into a land that he would give them. So this covenant they're agreeing to is truly revolutionary. Nothing like this had ever been done in the history of the earth. This is the 1400s BC. Some people think that democracy and letting the average person have a say and sort of this equality concept began with the Greeks in the 600s and 500s BC. Well, they were 900 years late. In fact, I would guess that many of their ideas came from their interaction with the ancient Israelites. So let's continue on down here. They agree in verse 3, yes, all these words we will do. Moses wrote all the words of the Lord. He rose up early in the morning. He built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars, so one pillar for each tribe of the tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. So they gave these offerings as kind of a celebration and a thank offering to God. Moses took half the blood, put it in basins, half he sprinkled on the altar. He took the book of the covenant, which would be these four chapters, and read in the hearing of the people. So he said, you heard it once, I'm going to have you hear it again. So they heard it again. And they said, yes, all the Lord has said we will do and be obedient. So twice they heard these words read, and twice they said, yes, we will do that. There is no fraud involved. There's no misunderstanding. They went over it very carefully. He then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, this is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to all these words. Very similar to Jesus Christ. He actually just rephrased this on the night of the Passover that he was betrayed. The blood of the new covenant, of course, was given as wine in a little glass. Then Moses went up, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. They made eye contact with the one who became Jesus Christ. There was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, that very shining glow called the glory of God that accompanies him wherever he goes. It was like the very heavens in its clarity. So we have this covenant that they agreed to, and they had a meal to celebrate this covenant coming together. And this was a completely different type of government than people had had before. And they were excited. They thought this is going to be a wonderful thing. But now how were they going to be judged? How were disputes going to be adjudicated? How were disagreements going to be decided? And most of all, how were crimes going to be accounted for? Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 10. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 10. Here Moses is rehearsing what had happened to them in their time of sojourning in the wilderness. And he reminds them that there was a time back when they were first coming out of Egypt, when everybody came to Moses. Everybody had all the complaints, all the problems, all the questions, and Moses simply couldn't answer them all. So his father-in-law, Jethro, gave him advice. And he said, seek out men who have four qualities. Anyone know what those four qualities are right offhand? Got them all memorized? It's pretty simple. Number one, they have to love God. Number two, they have to be men. Actually, no, number one is they have to be men of ability. Seek out men of ability. Number two, they have to love God. Number three, let me see. The fourth one is they can't take bribes. They can't be partial. And I think the third one is they must love mercy or justice, whatever it is. I'll have to think about those. Anyway, there are four qualities of leaders that God wants. Four qualities of leaders that God wants to have, allowed to have over the people of Israel. It's interesting, if you just look at those four qualities, write them down, and then analyze some of our recent presidents, some of our recent leaders in various ways. We've had men who have incredible ability, but they don't love God, they don't love truth, they don't have wisdom and understanding of God's ways, and they certainly give and take a lot of bribes. So we also have others who have had others who didn't take the bribes, were men of pretty good honesty and integrity, but didn't quite have the ability to carry out the responsibilities as well as they should have. And I'll leave you to make the decisions on those. I have opinions, but that's all they are, is opinions. Continue in Deuteronomy. Verse 13 of Deuteronomy 1. Choose wise, understanding, and knowledgeable men from among your tribes. I'll make them heads over you. So God says, through Moses, choose men who have these qualifications, and they'll become the heads over you. You answered me and said, the thing which you have told us to do is good. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and knowledgeable men, made of them heads over you, leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, leaders of tens, and officers for your tribes. So these men were to be qualified by their wisdom, their love of God, and their internal personal character. Now, these are not necessarily why people get voted in today or why kings have handed down their crowns to their sons. You know, the entire history of people giving their companies to their sons or their children, or of kings passing down leadership, oftentimes has been a miserable failure. He says, then I commanded your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your brethren, and judge righteously between a man and his brother, or the stranger that's with him. So these people were to be qualified by character, and they were to be judges. They were not to be kings. They were not to be owners. They didn't own people. They couldn't confiscate property. They simply were to apply the laws that God had given them to every situation they could. Notice verse 17. You shall not show partiality in judgment. One of the great problems of judging for all of us, but also for all magistrates, is the tendency to show partiality, to feel sorry for the one who might not have as much money, or to be in awe or respect or somehow looking at people who maybe have a status relationship, or maybe they've got lots of money, or they're, you know, kind of domineering. It says, you shall hear the small as well as the great. So the person who's very small, doesn't have a lot of money, is not socially well-heeled, not highly educated, is equal before the law, is what God says. We haven't done that in our land. All of these laws that God gave, when we as a nation have tried to adhere to them, we've been blessed. When we have veered away from them, we have brought a curse and division upon ourselves. For many, many years, we had what was called blind justice. You've all seen the statue in Washington, D.C. at the Supreme Court, where this lady's got these two this balance, and she's blindfolded because justice is not supposed to see the person. It's supposed to simply analyze the facts. We've replaced that now by legislating partiality into our law. We have things like affirmative action. We have separate laws for separate groups among us, such as the Indian tribes. You know, if we would simply listen to God, God said there shall be one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. No one shall have separate laws written just for them. So when we've done that, we've caused ourselves much grief and harm. So these judges were not to show partiality. They were to hear the small as well as the great. Says, you shall not be afraid in any man's presence. A judge was not to be intimidated because somebody had status or somebody had money or somebody had some reason to make that judge fear. We've all seen that. We've seen celebrities get off with murder. and more than one for sure. And we've seen people who perhaps didn't have a lot in society, didn't have enough money, you know, sitting in prison because they could not hire the lawyers and hire the right people to defend themselves. And my wife and I have a friend that's in that category right now. It says, if the case is too hard for you, bring it to me, and I will hear it. So these judges were there then to judge between people and to apply God's laws. Now, they were to study the law and know it, but do you know how many laws there are in the Scriptures that we are to obey? How many laws that we have that we should learn, that we should learn to obey and put into our life? Anybody have any ideas? No guesses? Fred should know. Got them all memorized, right? What? 10? Wow, a few more than that. Count all the judgments, all the statutes, and the other jaws. What did you say, Bill? 400? It's actually 613. There are 613 laws in the Bible that God gave us that we should live by and that we should make our judgments by. Of course, some of them are judgments, but law, statutes, and judgments adds up to 613. Now, sin is a transgression of the law. We break those laws, we sin. Nations violate God's laws all the time. It's simply a matter of degree. The way God wanted Israel set up, they would have a system where all of those laws could be applied and everybody would be blessed because of that. Let's go over to Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 10. This is a profound scripture. This concept here was absolutely new. Nobody had ever heard of this concept before. But here's what we have. It's something that, you know, keep in mind, these people had just come out of slavery for 215 years. They'd been strangers in a strange land for 430 years. All their ancestors had been. And so all of a sudden, they're being brought out, told they're going to have their own land, told they're going to be able to, you know, raise crops and have sheep and goats, and each family will have their own piece of land. Amazing. They couldn't believe it. Probably many of us can remember when we worked hard as young marrieds to buy our first house. It was pretty exciting. And the first house my wife and I bought was a little old white house in Pasco that on a 50-foot lot, an old World War II house, fairly small with, you know, kind of stucco inside with these arched doorways. And it was part of an estate. The widow who lived there died in her late 80s. And boy, to scrape and to, you know, to save and to get by and eat one meal a day, whatever it took, for almost a year to get enough money for what today would be a miserable small down payment. But it was exciting. You know, people still talk about the first house they bought and how neat it was. These people had never bought property. They had never owned a farm. All they'd been is slaves. We can only imagine how excited they were to say, hey, in a few weeks we're going to be crossing the promised land. And I wonder what kind of land my family will get. I wonder what kind of land your family will get. I wonder, you know, if we'll be able to produce, you know, wheat and all sorts of barley and vineyards. And they were probably more excited than we could imagine. But notice it says here in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 9, you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. Now that, of course, is the Day of Atonement. Today we have the last part of the last month. Next Sabbath is the first day of the 7th month. It's the new moon, the first day of the 7th month. 10 days later will be the Day of Atonement. Notice, on the Day of Atonement, you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. So we have the Day of Trumpets. We blow the trumpet, of course. But on the Day of Atonement, they were also to make the trumpet sound, and that was after 50 years, on the 50th year. You shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. Now, that had never been proclaimed before. Nobody had ever went to a nation and proclaimed everybody has liberty. They were all slaves. They all served tyrants. They all served kings. The kings could, you know, kill them, could take their children, could take their wives. I mean, this idea of proclaiming liberty throughout all the land was something entirely new. Now, many of you know that in Philadelphia, there's a large bell that has this verse in it. It was cast into it, and it's called the Liberty Bell because it has an inscription about the Day of Atonement on there that says, proclaim liberty throughout all the land and its inhabitants. And it tells us something interesting, very important, in fact, that the founding fathers that God caused, or for whatever reason were here, I believe God caused it to give us the blessings that he promised Abraham, that those founding fathers based not only the revolution of 1776, but also the documents that were formed on this book that we all have, the book called the Bible, God's Word. Those men also read extensively from Fox's Book of Martyrs and also from Cicero's book, Treatise on Natural Law. When you read Thomas Jefferson writing about the natural law and the laws of nature, he didn't just make that up. That came out of a great 200 B.C. Roman consul, Roman writer named Cicero, and he wrote about the concept of natural law, but he wasn't talking about just something made up. He said there is a God and a creator who has created a natural law, and it's the natural way things work. He was talking about a man and a wife becoming a family. He was talking about good returning good, evil returning evil, common respect of the average man. And Cicero had written that someday some nation will begin to apply all natural laws to their nation, and they'll be the greatest nation in history. In fact, Cicero, in a sense, was a much greater prophet than Nostradamus. But these men growing up in the 1700s in New England studied Latin, they studied Greek, and they studied Cicero. And so along with Cicero, we have, along with God's Word, we have Cicero, plus we have Fox's Book of Martyrs. But primarily the principles in our founding documents were based on this book. And they understood that men could not be trusted. So they had a check and balance system. They understood that power should not be concentrated because it corrupts. And so there were three sections or three levels of government, administrative, legislative, and judicial. And so they based the American Revolution on the concepts in Scripture, much documentation available for that, and it was the single most successful revolution in history. It brought about change all across the world, and certainly the concept that the average man could have land and could grow his family and live in freedom was revolutionary. The United States of America in the 1800s was the first nation in history where the average person was not in poverty, was not struggling with starvation. Now, a few years later, there was another revolution over in France in the 1780s. It was inspired somewhat by the American Revolution, but it was much different. The French Revolution, of course, saw the beheading of lots of people. We had Louis XVI murdered, all of his family. They set up guillotines all over France. They stormed the Bastille, mostly in Paris, of course. They put up guillotines. The French Revolution was against the gilded heads, against the rulers, and also against the Catholic Church. But what's the major difference? What writings was the French Revolution based on? The American was based on the Bible, and to some extent on classical writers. Who were the authors that were the basis of the French Revolution? Mr. Rowe, you know? There were two main authors who caused the French Revolution. All of you highly educated types should know this. This is very simple. You know, Fred? You're flunking today. Every question I ask you, you don't know the answer to. So, well, I'll tell you, no one even wants to venture a guess. Basically, it's Voltaire and Rousseau. Now, I don't speak French. I have read some translations of some of Voltaire and Rousseau. But it's called the Enlightenment, the Age of Enlightenment. And Voltaire and Rousseau said, we don't need God. We don't need kings. All we need is human wisdom. That the right kind of people, the elitists, those who are sort of destined by their nature to be smarter than others, if we get them in charge and we kick all the priests out, kick the Catholic Church out, kick all the kings out, kill all them, that we can enter into a society based on three words. Now, we all know the three words of the French Revolution, right? Libertad, then fraternity, and what was the last one? No, fraternity was the last one. Equalidad. Libertad, equalidad, and fraternity. In other words, everybody's liberty, everybody is free, and everybody has this fraternity. They were the ones that started the family of man based on the brilliance of men. Anybody can tell me what happened to the French Revolution, other than the fact that 18,000 priests got beheaded, along with most all the people in France that were educated, all their scientists. How long did it last? Well, it depends on what you talk about. If it was Robespierre, he started the first triumvirate, started ordering the guillotines. After a few years, they guillotined him. And those three were replaced by a council of 12, and that was replaced by somebody else. And finally, a man came along and said, this is a bunch of nonsense. I'm going to be the dictator. What was his name? Napoleon, 1796. So 9 years it lasted. What was the difference between the French Revolution and the American? For 100 years, France suffered as a feudal state. In fact, France was a miserable failure for all of the 1800s, a miserable place to live. They were several times steamrolled. Paris was occupied by the Prussians and the Germans. You see, the French Revolution was based on belief in man. Men are smart. Men can do it. They believed, get rid of God, get rid of all these kings, and let's just let these smart men run the country. The American Revolution was based on belief in God, that God is supreme. And if we put these principles of God's word into our nation and into the way it's organized, God will bless us because they are naturally good laws that automatically bring about blessings if you obey them. Now, what is happening in our nation for the past 30 years? We are turning the American Revolution into the French. Let me repeat that. The leaders of our country for the past 30 years have been turning the American Revolution into the French Revolution. God is kicked out, can't teach God anymore, but we can teach how wonderful man is. You know, high school graduations, everyone said, you know, follow your own heart, do what you think is right, don't let anybody else tell you what to do, find your own principles and live by them, whatever nonsense that means. Nothing is right, nothing is wrong, but they believe in men, and now an elitist group says they can provide everything for us, but from a standpoint of history, we have thrown away the American Revolution, and we are replacing it with the French. But the French Revolution is and was and always will be a miserable failure. Because why? Jeremiah 10 said, cursed is the man that trusts in man, and when we trust in God, we are blessed. But we're replacing that trust in God with a trust in man, and we are bringing a great curse upon ourselves. Now, if anyone thinks what I just said is wrong, please come talk to me. I've got plenty of documentation to prove that the philosophies that have taken over this country are the philosophy of the French Revolution, not the American. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 1. As God began to establish the land, here in Deuteronomy we have the last month before they're to cross the Jordan River and to begin occupying under Joshua all those pieces of land that God said he would give them. All nations around them were governed by dictators. How many kings, how many little potentates did they have to conquer and take over to control this land? Many of the kingdoms back then weren't any bigger than counties are today, or small counties for that matter. We have all of these Jebusites and Amorites, and each one of them had their own king because that was the only form of government known. And now God is going to have Joshua lead them into the promised land, conquer those areas, set up each family with its own piece of land that would come back to it every 50 years if they lost it, and they would establish a government that would proclaim liberty to all the land and to all the inhabitants thereof, something never before heard in history. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 1, now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to observe. Now, these are really includes all 613. They were to listen to the statutes and the judgments and live by them. That's the choice each one of us has. We are either going to listen to God, live by what he says, or we are not. He says, possess the land which the Lord your God, of your fathers, has given you. You shall not add to the word that I command you, nor take away from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. The big challenge all of us has is, are we going to obey God, or are we going to reason a way around it? Are we going to say, well, that's what God says, but, you know, yes, but I'd like to do it this way. Yes, but my circumstance. Well, yes, but I've got to wait before I can obey God. You ever read that book, Games People Play? It was a big bestseller back in the middle 70s. If you haven't read it, it's a good little read. It's a little paperback book you can get. But one of the games people play is called Yes, But. We've all of us who are parents have had children who played the Yes, But game. You know, Johnny, clean your room. Yes, but first I have to, you know, do whatever. You know, did you give back the money? Yes, but. So we all play the yes, but game. And if we catch ourselves playing the yes, but name with God, game with God, we'll find out that sometimes we don't want to obey him as much as we think we do. So we have to be diligent and be careful. Let's drop down a little bit farther. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor. That's where these people were punished for disobeying God. For the Lord your God has destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal Peor, but you held fast to the Lord your God and are alive today, every one of you. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. So Moses said, these statutes, these judgments, these laws are given to you so that when you are a nation, God will bless you, he'll protect you. Each head of the family will be responsible to God. You won't have to have a king. You won't have to have taxes. You won't have to have an army. All you have to have is the law and the judgments of God and live them. Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes. And they will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. And indeed, Israel, the modern descendants of Israel, have been a good example for many other nations. But sometimes we have tried to force a system of government that requires character on people who are totally corrupt. And it simply has not worked. But these people will see it, would say, verse 7, what a great nation is there that God is so near to it, as the Lord our God is to us. For whatever reason we may call upon him. And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are all in this law which I set before you today? That law was to be their guide. It was to guide them all the time that they were in the promised land. Of course, it didn't always work because they transgressed and they lost sight of it. Go over a couple chapters to chapter 12, Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 28. In this final book, Moses over and over says, look, obey God's laws that it may go well with you. It's true on a personal level. It is also true on a national level. When we have transgressed these laws, when we have not put these principles into our everyday life as a nation, we have paid the severe price for it. Verse 28, observe and obey all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and with your children after you forever. When you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. Of course, that's going to happen someday when Israel is reestablished in the promised land and this book is carried out word for word and they become an example to all people. That, of course, we'll be picturing during the feast. Let's go over to chapter 26 now and verse 19. Deuteronomy 26 and verse 19. These laws are natural. They're automatic. They bring a blessing when you obey them, collectively and individual. They bring a curse when you disobey them, on a collective scale and an individual scale. In Deuteronomy chapter 26 and verse 16, he says, this day the Lord your God commands you to observe these statutes and judgments. Therefore, you shall be careful to observe them with all your heart, with all your soul. Not part of you, but all of you. Today you have proclaimed the Lord to be your God, and that you will walk in his ways and keep his statutes, his commandments, and his judgments, and that you will obey his voice. And today the Lord has proclaimed you to be his special people. You know, what makes a person or a people special is that they obey God. Singing a song on American Idol is not what makes you special. Doing something crazy and getting written up in the National Enquirer doesn't make you special. Being a celebrity, having an early death by drug inducement or whatever it might be doesn't make you special. What makes a person special in God's eyes, because that lasts forever, are those who live according to his commandments, live according to what he wants us to do. He says, he will set you high above all nations which he has made in praise, in name, and in honor. And in fact, God has always done that with Israel. He's only used other nations to punish them as they have disobeyed, and the Canaanites or the Philistines were used to bring people back to their senses. Now over in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, the very last part of this of course is the section on blessing of obedience and disobedience. It shall come to pass if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. And indeed that happened about the year 1800, when the nations of Ephraim and Manasseh began to be high above all the nations of the earth. And in part, that was because of the principles in this book that were being applied in those lands. The blessing shall come upon you and overtake you, because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body and the produce of your ground, the increase of your herds and cattle. Now, a lot of that was because each family was to own their own land. And people are incredibly productive when they own their own land and they are able then to work it and reap the blessings. We're all very familiar with the Thanksgiving story with William Bradford and the lessons they learned. The first year the Pilgrims were in Massachusetts, they had communism. They all lent everything together and they were all to go out and work the fields same amount of time and then all gather in. And you've all heard the story, haven't you? You've read Braddock's book or Bradford's book of a Pilgrim colony, of Massachusetts colony. It's a great book. I bought it when I was back there. So the first year, everybody laid in bed. Not much happened. Not much was gathered. So he said, this is ridiculous. So then William Bradford assigned each family a plot of land and said, the only thing you're going to eat next year is what you grow yourself. And they produced over three times as much food that next year because each family went out and produced their own. And whatever they had left over, they could sell to the Indians, sell to each other. And so the main lesson of the Pilgrims in Plymouth Colony was that personal ownership and pride of hard work and the benefits of that hard work produces all kinds of good things, which is what God said here in the book of Deuteronomy. They would have their own land. Each family would have that. Later, in the year 1787, we passed the Northwest Land Ordinance that gave every family that homesteaded to the West 160 acres of their own property. And it became the greatest blessing any nation has ever seen as far as skyrocketing production, the Industrial Revolution, and the incredible blessings that became America during the 1800s. Sadly, since that time, many of those farms have been sold off. And now we are going back to the place where we have these massive corporations owning farms and all the workers on there being peasants. If you go over to Eastern Washington, you'll see a lot of that. Farms that all used to be 160 or 320 acres if a man and his wife each had title. And now they're all owned by big corporations, and they're primarily manned by illegals. So we need that law, the Jubilee, to give these farms all back to their family every 50 years. But God said, if you keep my commandments, which included how to organize the land, the Jubilee year, how to have each family set up with their landmarks, landmarks couldn't be moved, they couldn't lose their land. He said, blessed will be the fruit of your basket, your kneading bowl. Be blessed when you come in, when you go out. All of these laws establish blessings according to how God was to give them to them, according to how we obeyed them. Now, the next book tells a story. Let's go to Joshua chapter 13, beginning in verse 1. By the way, the book of Joshua covers how many years? How many years did it take for Joshua to conquer the Promised Land? This is another Bible trivia question. Mr. Reeves gave one last chance. You know? I know. Tony, you don't know either? We got to have more Bible questions. I'm not doing very well. Five. Joshua covers 5 years. It took 5 years to conquer the Promised Land. Now, in chapter 13 and verse 1, now Joshua was old and advanced in years. The Lord said to him, you are old, advanced in years, and there remains very much land yet to be possessed. So the people had taken the primary cities. The land had been divided up. But they began to, you know, feel like, well, we've been fighting for 5 years. I'm getting kind of worn out. I got this nice piece of land and my family owns. I got a wife. I got a couple kids. I want to go build a house. I want to go harvest grapes. I don't really feel like going and fighting anymore, Ashkelonites or Ekronites or Avites. So what happened is they didn't divide the land entirely because there was still some to be conquered. And God allowed that to happen as a test for them in later years, although they certainly later regretted it. Down in verse 7, therefore divide this land as an inheritance to the 9 tribes and the half-tribe of Manasseh. The other tribes, Reubenites and Gadites, had their inheritance in Gilead on the east side of the Jordan Valley. And so this entire book, at least big sections of it, cover which territory belonged to which tribes. And so then they were to set up exactly how they were to, you know, each have their own family. Each man went to his inheritance by lot, verse 14. And chapter 14 and verse 2, Joshua 2 and verse 14 and verse 2, their inheritance was by lot. They would cast lots as to which tribe and which family then would receive which pieces of land. As the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses for the 9 tribes and the half tribe. So here we have the land being divided up, and the perfect form of human government as instituted by God was to take place. Where each head of the house was responsible to God, to learn God's ways, to teach his children. God would protect them. They would have Levites to teach them the law and to read them everything Moses had read. And they had the feast days. They had cities of refuge. The tithes were being collected by the Levites. That was their wages for doing all the teaching of God's people. There were to be judges who would make judgments, but they were men of integrity. They were not kings. They were not tyrants. They were simply men to make judgments based on the laws and the words of God. That's the way it will be worked out and set up in the world tomorrow. This is the pattern of how God is going to do things, first for Israel, but then later as an example for all other nations to follow. There will be no Nimrods, there will be no Saddam Husseins, there will be no Fidel Castros, there will be no Idi Amins, there will be no Mao Zedongs, there will be no Hitlers, any of those guys in God's kingdom. But what happens is sad. In Judges chapter 12, Judges chapter 12 and verse 8, these judges, unfortunately, proved Lord Acton right many years before he lived, that power causes corruption and complete power corrupts completely. So these judges lost sight of their character qualifications, and we have here in Judges 12 the beginning of judges misusing their positions and beginning to rule over people. Judges 12 and verse 8, after him, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel. He had 30 sons. Well, I can tell you he had more than one wife. No one wife would have 30 sons. He gave away 30 daughters in marriage, so he had 60 children, and brought in 30 daughters from elsewhere to his sons. He judged Israel 7 years. Then we have other guys that come along. Verse 14, he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons, rode on 70 young donkeys. So this guy, Abdon, just rode around in a parade all the time, saying, here I am, I'm the judge, I'm the big guy. And eventually they began to rule and lord it over people in a way that was wrong. From this time forward, we have some very difficult experiences for the people of Israel because these judges simply did not have the character qualifications to obey God and to humbly do the work they were told to do. Over in chapter 21, chapter 21 and verse 24, towards the very end, we find that people all went to their own inheritance, but there was no king in Israel, and they began to all doing what was right in their own eyes. They didn't do what was right in God's eyes because they had lost so much of that knowledge. The greatest test anyone can ever face is prosperity. Time and again throughout the scriptures, it's the one test people simply cannot fail, cannot pass. Verse 20, the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and to his family. They went out from there, every man to his own inheritance. In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So we have a sad story that in just a couple hundred years, I think Judges covers, 280 years, we have people who were given the perfect form of government, with God as their king and their lord, with a system that had they continued to monitor their character and live by every word of God as they had, could have been a blessing for all time. But they began to wander. They began to think about anything except God. Before long, they were being put into captivity and slavery and being afflicted by wars and other nations. And they then forfeited that perfect and right form of human government. And before long, they had to have a king. And, of course, that's the next saga, in the story of ancient Israel. So this was still in about the 1100s, 1200s B.C., when this took place, probably the early 1100s. From that time forward, we find some interesting things happening in places like Greece and also over the area that became ancient Rome. And so we'll talk about some of those things next time.